Tariffs, we've been told, have winners and losers. Today, White House Economic Advisor Gary Cohn seems to be on the losing end. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 6th day of March. Today, good as always to have you along, everybody. Gary Cohn spent a year and a couple of months as the head of the National Economic Council of the White House, a free trade Democrat in a populist Republican administration. The tenure, though, came to an end. Today, Cohn says he plans to resign his job. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams is live with me in the studio. Hey.
Hi, Kai.
So why now? This is not the first time there have been rumors of Gary Cohn's resignation.
Yes, and the markets usually don't like those rumors.
Yeah.
But this time is different. Gary Cohn has been sort of leading this fight against the steel and aluminum tariffs the president has been pushing for that you've been talking about for the last several days. And there was this big fight in the White House, sort of the Gary Cohn versus Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross and Trade Advisor Peter Navarro. The New York Times that broke this story said that there is no single reason, according to the White House, that Cohn is leaving. But, I mean, the context is obvious here.
So now what happens? I mean, it's not like there isn't going to be trade policy.
Right. But if you look at the bench in the White House of the people who are making that trade policy, it looks a lot different now. I mean, you've got a lot of people who have a very protectionist mindset, very focused on domestic policy as opposed to global free trade. And the president really seems to be digging in on the tariffs, on wanting more protectionist policies. And the voices in the White House that may have been pushing against him are now gone.
The name we're going to be hearing a lot of the rest of this day and tomorrow is Peter Navarro. Very quick sketch on him. He is a protectionist now to his core.
Right. And he wrote a book on China. Yep. He is particularly focused on being very worried about our trade deficits with China and China sort of taking over our place in the world in terms of trade. And so now he's been obviously elevated in his voice in the White House.
Kimberly Adams. In the studio with me here for a change.
I know, not in D.C. for once.
Thanks.
Bye.
Before that Cohn news broke, this was shaping up as week two of tariff week, or weeks, I suppose, at the White House. The president has said, as you know, he is going to sign them 25% on steel, 10% on aluminum, sometime in the next couple of days. And then today, question number one during the joint press conference he had with the prime minister of Sweden was basically, sir, are you still serious about this in the face of corporate opposition and opposition from your fellow Republicans?
Well, the United States has been taken advantage of by other countries, both friendly and not so friendly, for many, many decades.
Fair enough. It is what the president has been saying since he started running for this job.
And we have a trade deficit of $800 billion a year.
To be clear, the president's own Commerce Department says the trade gap last year, the difference, remember, between what we sell overseas and what we import, was only $566 billion. But why quibble? Here's the real point.
When I was with President Xi in China, as an example, we lose $500 billion a year on trade. We have a deficit of approximately $500 billion a year with China.
All right, hold it right there. Let's play that first bit again, all right?
We lose $500 billion a year on trade.
That right there, the losing thing, that is a misapprehension of what a trade deficit actually is. Marketplace's Ryan Kailath is on explainer duty today.
I got to confess, I too am extremely upset about trade deficits, specifically the deficit I'm currently running with my lunch spot, Pret a Manger. I buy a sandwich there almost every day, and Pret never buys anything from me. Monica DeBole of the Peterson Institute says I could remedy this deficit.
Well, you could always go to a grocery store and buy everything that goes into that sandwich. But if it's a complicated sandwich, if it has, you know, chicken salad and bacon and lettuce and tomato, it means you would have to do all that work yourself, whereas it might be more efficient just to go to Pret and get it there.
Now, the U.S. isn't running trade deficits because it's too lazy to make a sandwich. It's often because for both governments and regular people, getting stuff from abroad is just cheaper than buying or making it at home.
If you are a country that consumes more than you produce,
which we are,
you have to buy those goods from somewhere else,
which we do. The U.S. imports more than it exports. DeBole says that's not a bad thing. It's also not a good thing. It's just a thing.
A trade deficit is simply the result of a transaction. So in return for the money that you spend, you get the goods, just like you and your sandwich.
The trade deficit by itself is not a problem.
Ishwar Prasad with the Brookings Institution says what can become a problem is when governments borrow too much to pay for all that stuff they're buying from other countries.
Someday the bill will come due.
Prasad says if you want to address the trade deficit, tariffs aren't the way. A better approach is to just make your economy healthier. Reduce budget deficits, make exports more competitive, create a sensible tax system. Of course, all of that is hard to fit in a tweet. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
Quick detour on the way to the numbers here. You have heard me say, I don't know how many times on this program, if you want to know what's going on with the economy, watch the bond market, right? Well, we put together a quick video explainer with a little bit of help from Game of Thrones. Check it out on YouTube. We are at Marketplace APM. Subscribe to our channel while we're there, if you would. Equities, meanwhile, a little choppy. We will have the details and the 10-year Treasury, of course, when we do the numbers. There's been a whole slew of retail companies going bankrupt the past couple of years. Big names, too. Toys R Us, Payless, the Limited stores, Gymboree, also Sports Authority. And most of the time, the conversation about why comes back to online competition, Amazon in particular. But there is something else going on here as well. Before they went bankrupt, all of the companies I just mentioned had been owned by private equity firms, investment companies that, in the process of buying up those retailers, also loaded them down with debt. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra explains what's going on with the story of Toys R Us.
In middle school, I took the train into Manhattan with some friends. We spent the afternoon at the 110,000-square-foot Toys R Us flagship store in Times Square. We rode a 3-story indoor Ferris wheel, wandered through a life-size Barbie dream house, stared up at a giant animatronic T-Rex. Okay, it was kind of over the top. But that was Toys R Us. Stephanie Wissink is a managing director at Jefferies.
It was every little child's dream manifested physically in this grand place with toys, endless aisles of toys.
Toys R Us was founded in 1948 in Washington, D.C. as a baby furniture business. By the mid-80s, it was a public company with hundreds of toy stores around the world and more than $1 billion in sales.
I don't want to grow up on Toys R Us.
But soon, the company started losing ground to discount chains. In the late 90s, Walmart took over as the country's number one toy seller. In 2004, after years of flat sales and falling profits, the Toys R Us board of directors put the company up for sale. The buyers were a group of private equity firms. Those are investment firms that bundle together money from investors to buy companies. They fix them up by cutting costs and increasing sales and then sell them. Donna Hitcherich is a professor at Columbia Business School.
They make money the old-fashioned way, right? You buy low and you sell high. So you try to find an opportunity that you can improve upon.
And to really get what happened with Toys R Us, you got to understand how these private equity purchases work. They rely on something called a leveraged buyout. Eileen Applebaum co-directs the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
Leverage just means you're using lots of debt.
If a private equity firm wants to buy a company, it'll put up a small portion of the money. Then it'll go to the bank and borrow the rest. And here's the key.
They put the debt on the company they buy.
The firms take out this loan, buy a company like Toys R Us, and then make Toys R Us pay the loan back. In 2005, the Toys R Us board of directors sold the company for nearly $7 billion to the private equity firms Bain Capital and KKR and the real estate investment firm Vornado. The firms put up about 20% of the total and borrowed the rest. And Toys R Us became a private company with more than $5 billion in debt. Then things kind of went off the rails. Charlie O'Shea is a retail analyst at Moody's.
The beginning of the problems for toys was that Amazon.com exploded.
During the next 5 years, sales at Amazon quadrupled to $34 billion.
Amazon went into the toy sector in a big way and added one more big competitor for Toys R Us.
To compete, Toys R Us would have had to invest significantly in its website and stores. But the retailer was using most of its available cash to pay back its debt. And that's the thing about leveraged buyout deals. They leave companies with a lot of debt and almost no cash. So if something goes wrong in the industry, it's hard to survive. Which brings us to summer 2017. Sales at Toys R Us had fallen for 5 years. management hired lawyers to push off the company's next loan payment. Word got out that the company might go bankrupt, and toy makers panicked. One CEO, who asked to remain anonymous because he still does business with Toys R Us, was about to send millions of dollars worth of toys to the retailer.
We were canceling vessels. We were doing everything we could to stop new goods getting on the water.
Other toy makers demanded Toys R Us pay them up front in cash. The retailer didn't have it. And that's what drove the company to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy in September. It's closing about a fifth of its stores. Toys R Us and the private equity firms declined an interview. Vornado didn't respond. The private equity firm's investors haven't made money off this deal, but the firms themselves have. It's unclear where Vornado ended up, but after collecting fees from Toys R Us, both Bain and KKR took home at least $15 million. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
There are billions of sneakers out there in circulation in the global economy. Running shoes, tennis shoes, cross trainers, billions of them. People put them on every day and probably don't give them a second's thought, but the truth is, making them is a nightmare. They are labor-intensive, and it takes months to get a pair of sneakers to market. So Adidas is trying to do something about it. It is building a brand new sneaker factory in Germany, Speed Factory, they call it. Mark Bain is a fashion reporter at Quartz. He wrote recently about his trip to the Speed Factory this past summer. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Before we start talking about how Adidas is proposing or making sneakers in this newfangled factory, tell me how they're made now, most times.
So your sneakers are not made in one factory. They're made over this sprawling network of specialized factories. The outsole could be made in a factory in one country in Asia. The midsole could be made in a factory in an entirely different country in Asia. And then you have all the pieces of the upper. It might be like a knit fabric. It might be leather. Again, that stuff is like produced one place. It can be cut and then stitched in other places. Eventually, it all ends up in this one factory where they put a final sneaker together. But it's a long process.
Wow. All right. So in Ansbach, Germany, Adidas and a partner have spent, safe to say, hundreds of millions of dollars. They're not saying exactly how much, but a whole lot of money to build this Speed Factory. And how is it changing sneaker production?
So the Speed Factory centralizes everything. It's concentrating all of these different processes into one place. It's also streamlining everything. First off, a lot of it is automated. So in the Speed Factory, instead of like 60 days to produce a sneaker, they can do it in a matter of days. They can actually do it in a matter of hours. But there are certain parts of the sneaker, like the way they make the outsole, it actually has to rest.
Like sit there, like after you get meat off the grill, it has to rest?
It's got to stabilize, and it takes a couple of days. So actually, the slowest part of the process is just waiting for this stuff to happen. Otherwise, they could actually assemble a sneaker in hours.
That's wild. All right, let me pick up on a couple of things you talked about. Automation. It's one thing to automate a car factory, right? Because you go in there, and I've been to car factories all over the place, and they're moving these big chunks of metal around with robots, and that makes sense. But with a pair of sneakers, you're dealing with relatively fragile pieces of cloth and rubberish stuff, and that's got to be a whole different deal.
Yeah, it is. It's a funny thing that I don't think people really realize, but automating sneaker production is a really big challenge. It's a big hassle because you're dealing with these soft parts that robots are just not very good at handling.
All right. So here's the $64,000 question. At the end of the day, is a sneaker or a running shoe or what have you made in the Speed Factory better than something that is made the traditional way?
Not necessarily. First off, one thing that's worth understanding is they're only making a limited range of products at the Speed Factory.
Right.
They're focusing
it's a
on
test
these premium.
Bed, right? Yeah.
Yeah, they're making the premium performance shoes that are actually designed specifically to be made there. So they've been designed to be made with, as few steps as possible, essentially.
Right.
They want to make the next generation of sneakers there, not the previous generation.
The next generation of sneakers. It's kind of amazing, right?
Yeah, it's really impressive when you walk into the place. So I got a chance to go visit in July as part of a group of journalists who's the first to step foot in there. And it was just efficient is definitely the word I would use to describe it.
Mark Bain, he's a fashion reporter at Quartz. Great piece on the German Adidas Speed Factory over in Ansbach, Germany. Mark, thanks a lot for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Coming up.
Nobody knows hip-hop and nobody knows the new American culture better than them, in my mind.
The three kings of American hip-hop. But first, let's do the numbers. Kind of boring, actually, today in equities. Dow Industrials up 9 points, less than a tenth percent, 24,884. NASDAQ gained 41 points, about a half percent, 73.72. S&P 500 up 7 points, two-tenths percent, 27.28. Don't get me wrong, by the way, boring is fine. Target dropped 4.4% today on worse-than-expected fourth-quarter earnings. The retailer said the cost of overhauling its stores and beefing up its website were a factor. Nordstrom, though, up 1.1% after the department store rejected an offer from the Nordstrom family to take the company private. CVS faded 0.9% today. The pharmacy chain plans to sell $44 billion in bonds to help fund its acquisition of the health insurer Aetna. Aetna came down 0.1%. Bond prices, treasuries that is, they fell slightly. Yield on the 10-year treasury note remains at 2.88%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Here is a quick historical fact that might bring you up short. Bear Stearns and its Fed and Treasury negotiated sale to J.P. Morgan was 10 years ago next week, arguably the moment at which a lot of people really started paying attention to the financial crisis and thinking about the recession that was to come. We're calling our project about the past 10 years in our economic lives, Divided Decade. And we've been hearing from people all over the country about how the crisis changed them. Today, Megan Millay, she teaches economics at East Carolina University.
Before the Great Recession happened, it was really hard to get students interested in listening to what was happening in the macro economy. It just seemed like I was droning on about fiscal policies and macroeconomic stability, and then it happened, the Great Recession. It was in the news all the time. It was everywhere, and students were really interested. They really wanted to know what's going on, what's going to happen next, are we going to be okay? And so it was really great to be in a position where students went from marginally engaged to really wanting to know, edge of their seat, rock star status. It was great. It made my interaction with students more intense, more real, more visceral. Even though it has negative consequences, being able to give students the tools to understand that they were going to be okay, that it was predictable, that there were things that they could do to insulate themselves, provides a lot of empowerment. The Great Recession had a significant impact on the way that students see the world in particular. The students used to think that a good job meant that they were going to get high pay, and now students think of a good job as stable employment, something that they can count on. It's changed the things that we value. It changes the way that we think about what it is that we want.
We've got some pictures of Megan Millay on our Instagram. We are at Marketplace APM. You can let us know how the financial crisis changed you while you're there. The hashtag we're using is HowWeChanged. The three richest American musicians of any kind of music all come from hip-hop. Diddy, Dr. Dre, and Jay-Z combined net worth well over $2 billion. The real money they've made, though, hasn't come from their music. It's liquor brands and Beats headphones for Dr. Dre, music streaming services, to name just a couple. And they made it, the three of them did, in the face of racism and a mainstream resistance to hip-hop. So in a way, they were forced to be entrepreneurs. That is the through line of a new book by Zach O'Malley Greenberg. It's called The Three Kings, Diddy, Dr. Dre, Jay-Z, and hip-hop's multi-billion dollar rise. Zach, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me on.
You say in this book at some point, if these three guys took Myers-Briggs tests, the personality tests,
yeah,
they would each come out completely differently. I mean, they are very, very different people.
They sure are, you know, and I forget the exact terminology of ENTJ whatever it is, but I think a lot of people look at those three guys and they say they have the same job description, right? Hip-hop mogul. But really, you couldn't get more different in terms of personality. On one end of the spectrum, you've got Dr. Dre, who's admittedly very shy, kind of an anxious dude, very reclusive, but he's a perfectionist. And he works on his albums for years and years and years, sometimes shelves entire albums, has 500 songs in his vault unreleased because they're not perfect enough. He's only put out three full-length albums in his career.
That's like a gazillion dollars sitting in the vault.
Yeah. And Beats by Dr. Dre was his one real non-musical venture, but he spent so many years honing and perfecting it that it turned out to be this $3 billion business, at least according to Apple, who bought it for that much in 2014.
And then you look at the other two, and they're so much more public, right?
Yeah, I mean, especially Diddy. He's sort of the traditional salesman. He's out there in clubs and bars telling bartenders to put Ciroc vodka on a higher shelf, you know.
So he's a micromanager. That's another way of saying that,
exactly,
right?
Very extroverted, very outgoing. Jay-Z's somewhere in the middle. In the meeting, he's the guy who's kind of hanging back, and then he'll come in and deliver the point after he's gauged the room, kind of taking the temperature, that kind of thing.
We should point out here the importance of fashion as a turning point in the careers of these three guys, from music stars to other big branded kinds of things.
For sure. And certainly throughout the 90s, American mainstream and really international pop culture was starting to take fashion cues from hip hop. And in fact, there was a moment at which Jay-Z had a meeting with a brand called Iceberg. He was rapping about this brand a lot and basically asked for some kind of endorsement deal. And the people at Iceberg would maybe give them free clothes, and that was it. Wow. I mean, but maybe. And so Jay-Z went off and said, you know, I'm going to start my own. And that's how he started Rockaware. That's how Diddy started Sean John, you know, and they were able to build up these streetwear brands into nine-figure companies, especially during the late 90s heyday of that type of clothing.
How do you reconcile the brand awareness, I suppose, and influence these three men have with the roots of hip-hop and rap, and specifically their own individual histories with violence, violence against women, and all of that?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Just to clarify, you know, Jay-Z and Diddy have never been accused of any violence against women. All three of them have had their episodes, run-ins with the law. There are a lot of people who rose from, you know, sort of somewhat nefarious means and then kind of came to a more mainstream acceptable kind of a place. I mean, JFK's dad, right? He was a bootlegger. I mean, Jay-Z acknowledges that. He says, cut from the cloth of the Kennedys. So I think there's also circumstance. If you don't look a certain way, are you going to get the attention of the police? And it's, you know, it was a different world that they lived in coming up in the 70s and 80s, you know, than the one we live in today.
Do you think people in the business world take these three as seriously as they take Elon Musk and Branson and Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and all the rest of them?
I think they're, over the past few years, they have gotten to a place where they are taken that seriously. And, you know, I think there's been an awakening of recognition that hip hop is not just this sort of one-off youth fad. It is merged with and overtaken mainstream American culture, and that really in order to tap into some of that consumer demand, you have to be conversant in hip-hop. Yeah. Nobody knows hip-hop, and nobody knows the new American culture better than them, in my mind.
Zach O'Malley Greenberg, he writes, he's a senior editor, rather, at Forbes. His latest book about Diddy, Dr. Dre, and Jay-Z is called Three Kings. Zach, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me on.
There is more about these three at our website, including a poll. You can tell us which mogul you think you've got the most in common with. Me? I'm going to abstain, I think. Also, an excerpt of Zach's book. It's at marketplace.org. Final note on the way out today, a quickie because we're a little tight on time, offered without value judgment. Merriam-Webster, the dictionary people, have added the word dumpster fire to their latest edition. Insert your own. 2018 joke here. But for reals, the National Fire Protection Association says there were 163,000 actual dumpster fires in this country in 2015. So now you know. Holy cow, look at the time. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Star Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.